Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I'm eating already. Nobody has made any pie yet, and yet I'm still eating.
I would love to eat, but I'm afraid of smearing the lipstick and the makeup because I put it on with a trowel.
From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman. You're listening to Good Food, and today we start out baking with Bertha.
I am from the great state of Minnesota, out there, oh yeah, where it snows. And I come from a town called Gopher Prairie, Minnesota. It's a lot like a Norman Rockwell painting, except we have a target and a crystal meth problem. Anyway, I want to encourage you all to drink more, because the more you drink, the funnier I get, and the pie will taste so much better, okay?
Imagine if RuPaul and Rosen Island had a baby and then threw in a dash of Julia Child. You'd get Bertha, a Midwestern pie-baking drag queen who lives by the motto, feel bitter, add butter, feel better. Bertha is the comedic creation of the Chicago transplant Michael Bowen. When he performs as Bertha, it's not typically in bars or nightclubs. Instead, he leads Baking with Bertha private performances that usually happen in homes or churches for small groups of eight or so people. They are equal parts baking class and comedy set. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Evan.
I had so much fun at your class a few days ago.
I'm so glad you attended. It was a wonderful time, and I'm so glad that you got a chance to see what Baking with Bertha is and experience it in the flesh.
Yeah, now I'm curious about Michael. So tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, what your childhood was like, and how your upbringing kind of led to Bertha.
Okay, perfect. I grew up in upstate New York. So I was, it's a small town, probably about 5,000 people, about 3.5 hours outside of New York City. And I had a single mom and a sister and a lot of aunts and grandmother. My grandmother, who was very stern and kind of cold, but made really good pies and potato salad. I mean, I was the favorite grandchild and everyone doted on me. But as I grew older and I kind of became aware of my sexuality, about not really wanting to live in a small town, the relationship between my aunts and my grandmother really became strained. We couldn't talk about anything, really, and I was a bit of an outsider. But I really missed that kind of connection of family and home and place. And so when I around about 2000, I started writing letters to my aunts and my grandmother and trying to get their recipes and stuff. And it started this whole thing where they just started sending me pie recipes and sending me kind of ideas for different pies and different kind of really nostalgic food. And so I was cooking that at the same time. The character of Bertha was born in 1997 in a theater company in upstate New York. I was a prop master. And at the end of the season, they had like a party for all the technicians, for everyone to kind of just let steam off. And the character of Bertha was created. It just came fully formed. And I lip-synced to a song by Patsy Cline called Honky Tonk Merry-Go-Round. And then I've been just performing and developing this character. And in Chicago, I would go to the Gay Pride Parade and hand out penis-shaped cookies. And people just loved it. And this character just kept developing. And someone said, you need to have a show. So I rented out a Lutheran church and I put on Bertha Mason's Rhubarb Poetry Jam, where I made butterscotch blondies and read from the old newspaper and took question and answer and started just to develop this character. And it just blossomed for the past 25 years, all crazy development of kind of by chance, by luck, and just saying, hey, let's do a very Mickey Judy kind of feeling of let's put on a show. So that's how it kind of developed.
At a certain point, you got serious about baking and you went to culinary school where you earned a degree in pastry. Was that to give Bertha more chops? What was the reason you ended up going to culinary school?
I've always been interested in food, and I've always cooked, and I've always loved food. At the time, I was working for the federal government. I was a recruiter for the Corporation for National Community Service, which oversees AmeriCorps. I served in AmeriCorps. I love the idea of service, and I was working there, and it was fine. And one day, I was walking across the Federal Plaza in Chicago, and I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. What do I want to do? And I thought, I want to bake pies. I'm happiest when I'm baking pies. And so I literally quit my job, enrolled in Kendall College, and got a degree in baking and pastry arts. And my life kind of took a change from there because I started working in Chicago at very different restaurants. And I had the greatest opportunity of working at Hoosier Mama Pie Company. And the owner, Paula Haney, worked at Alinea, and she really loved pie. And she taught me both about how to make good pie, but also using locally sourced ingredients, and also the importance of being precise and just kind of like that chef training, but devoted to pie.
God, I love such a great story. So going back to sort of this character that you created, Bertha, there was a particular character you were obsessed with as a child. Who was it, and how did her fabulousness inspire you?
It was Cruella de Vil. And in fourth grade, I took a date to see 101 Dalmatians, and my date brought a date, and I didn't know what to do, but I was like, oh my God, it's a date, and I have to be here, and I was so traumatized and struggling with how to be like cool, and it didn't matter when Cruella de Vil came on the screen, and she was so larger than life, and she was smoking, and she didn't like dogs, and she was just everything that I didn't know I needed growing up in this small conservative town upstate New York. And I just love that she was so quick and used big words and was just over the top evil. And then she got to sit in bed and smoke and have her henchmen take care of all the terrible things. So it was quite wonderful. And so I became obsessed with Cruella de Vil, and I'd like wear an afghan and pretend to like smoke with a pretzel rod. And everyone thought I loved 101 Dalmatians. So people gave me Dalmatians. But I couldn't say, in 1986 or 87, hey, I'm a young gay man who really likes this woman and I want to be this person because she's so fantastic. So people just gave me Dalmatians instead.
That's so funny. So when did Bertha and baking combine?
Baking and Bertha combined almost immediately from the start. And it was going out and giving treats, blondies, butterscotch blondies. They're always known as the family favorite because it's six simple recipes. They travel well. And people were just so enamored by the character. And this is in the late 1990s and early 2000s when drag was still very much a nighttime thing and very, very seen as something other. And what I love about the character, and I love being the character, is that it really is about being welcoming. Like, people want to hug Bertha. People want to be close to Bertha. And I think that it's a way to create an idea of home for those who can't go home because of distance, because of family problems. And Bertha is this kind of nurturing, sarcastic, just a little out of step figure who wants to communicate love through food. The pie baking class kind of started, on a whim. Chicago is wonderful for kind of developing things because there's so many theaters and so many small places where you can walk them. It's like, hey, I want to do a show. And they're like, pay $75. You get this space. And I just kind of came up with this idea of let's make pie. And it happened. And I would just work at Hamburger Mary's once a month, and I would do a different pie-themed show, an apple pie, a groundhog's pie, whatever it was. And it just kept blossoming. And so at one point when I was in Chicago, I've done a lot of church work. Bertha's really big with churches, like the Catholics, the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, the Methodists. I've done a few temples. Everyone just loves Bertha. But what I did is I rented out a Lutheran church, and I had my friends who worked at the Ritz-Carlton and the Peninsula in Chicago put together real Midwestern tuna noodle casserole turkey dinner, and we had a queer polka band called Queer as Polka, and Bertha did a whole Midwestern feed. And it was wonderful because there was hipsters and bears and lesbians and old people, and a busload of Lutherans came in from the suburbs. And I thought, this is really what I want drag and community to be, where it's something other, but it comes together into a familiar sense of togetherness.
And what kind of pies does Bertha favor for her classes? At the class I attended, we baked a really delicious lemon Chess blueberry pie, and we also sampled a Toll House chocolate chip pie. Are these Bertha's standards?
For the classes, Bertha likes to make the lemon pie, a chocolate pie, the Toll House pie, a fruit pie, and a sour cream raisin pie. Different pies that have skills that are basic skills, but also will show different methods. So the participants who may have never picked up a rolling pin or a spatula in their life will kind of learn all these different methods, the biscuit method, the creaming method. So when they go back, I don't know if they'll ever make a pie again, but they'll look at a recipe and think, oh, I've done that. I know what it is. It's less terrifying. This is something that I've experienced and I kind of have awareness of. I'm a big fan of the sour cream raisin pie, and I think everyone should engage in a sour cream raisin pie, but raisins get a bad rap, and people really don't want to eat sour cream and raisin, but it's such an old-timey, classic thing, such so Midwestern. I want to create that feel of nostalgia in a recipe, that taste of home, the taste of memory, because nothing tastes as good as memory.
That's true. Well, thank you so much, Michael. It was such a pleasure to meet you, experience Bertha, and get to have this conversation.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you so much for Baking with Bertha.
That was Michael Bowen, the creator and star of Baking with Bertha. Want to book her to host a baking comedy performance for you and your friends? Well, you can head to our website for details. Or KCRW members can donate right now to be entered to win a Baking with Bertha class for you and five of your friends. Members who pledge today, Saturday, March 25th, or tomorrow, Sunday, March 26th, will automatically be entered into our Baking with Bertha sweepstakes. How awesome is that? And for those of you looking for that sour cream raisin pie, we've got the recipe at kcrw.com/goodfood. It was delicious. Oh, and for all you bakers entering this year's KCRW Pie Fest and Contest, Bertha has some words of wisdom for you.
I think you have to just make sure to practice. And the way, I mean, I just made tons of bad pie, and you can bring it around to your neighbors. You can bring it to friends. You can give it to people when security asks you to leave premises. And everyone loves some good pie.
If you haven't entered yet, go to kcrw.com/pie.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Why do two lawyers decide to enter the much more perilous and less lucrative world of hospitality? Because they want a cafe that reflects their identity, one where Black people feel welcome, where they can enjoy all the perks of cafe culture. That hadn't always been easy to find for Shanita Nicholas and Amanda Jane Thomas. When they opened Sip and Sonder at the end of 2018, it was the first specialty coffee house in predominantly Black Inglewood. But Shanita and Amanda Jane always saw it as more than a cafe. They wanted to create a community-minded venture complete with a roastery, a creative space, and live events. Now, with three locations, Sip and Sonder is the subject of this week's In the Weeds.
My name is Shanita Nicholas, one of the co-founders of Sip and Sonder.
My name is Amanda Jane Thomas, and I am one of the co-founders of Sip and Sonder. So Sonder is from the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows. And the definition, it's the realization that everyone around you is living a life that's as vivid and complex and beautiful as your own, right? Full of its own ups, downs, struggles, happiness, joy, everything. And it's such an amazing word. We love it so much that it's part of our company name, because it really is really at the root of what we're all about. When I hear Sonder, I think about a way for me and others to connect with each other. And it really is that starting point of connection, just like coffee. Coffee is the great connector as well. And so the Ishan there was just obvious to us and really was like, okay, Sip and Sonder, that's the name of our company. No, I never would have imagined that I would be in food and beverage, if I'm really honest. You know, eventually being at Sip and Sonder and what we're doing now really was kind of the culmination of a path that took some turns and twists.
You know, Amanda, Jane and I met at our very first law firm working together, and it really did become, now typical New York corporate legal office, working around the clock, kind of leaving myself at the door when I would walk into that space, which also meant leaving the stories that were happening around the country, within the Black community in particular, and kind of more broadly, just happening around the world, and not being able to bring that aspect of feelings and conversation and reality into the workplace. But I really enjoyed the time that I got to spend with the other Black women inside of the firm, and started creating meetups for us to get together and inside of the firm to share what we were experiencing as individuals. And Amanda was such a crucial part of that experience. So, you know, we got to talk about all of the things we dreamed about, what we wanted to be in life and do. And in college, I would always say, you know, to my friends, when I grow up and work and then afterwards retire, my retirement, I want to have a coffee shop and be a barista.
You know, for a while during my legal practice, when I first started, I immediately knew that that wasn't it. And so I kind of immediately began that search of, okay, what do I really want to be when I grow up? When coffee entered the conversation, and Shanine and I would just talk about coffee, you know, I said, if we're going to, you know, do kind of and foray into coffee, it's really the coffee and more, right? Like, how are we really going to approach this amazing product, create something that is quality, but then also everything else that it will enable us to do? Our nonprofit right now, our 501c3 nonprofit, is known as Sonder Impact, but it was formerly known as the LA Black Investors Club, which before Sip and Sonder came into crystallization, so when Shanita first moved out here doing that work, and I was still living in New York, but having programming in South Los Angeles, in Inglewood, and that organization at the time was squarely focused on entrepreneurship. How are we focusing on our professional capacity building within Black and Brown communities? And I remember at that time, we were doing so much of our programming in places that now are our neighbors, you know, like in Inglewood. One of our programs in 2016, for example, was at the Miracle Theater, which is right down the street from us. And so we were already in the neighborhood, in the community, doing work through the nonprofit. And so once Sip and Sonder kind of entered the scene, it was a natural choice that is where we were going to start to build.
What's been so incredible to see in our placement on Market Street is also the growth of small business, especially Black and Brown-owned small businesses in the area as well. Now around the corner from us, there's a Black woman-owned bookstore, the Salt Eaters, the Residency Gallery, numerous list of these really incredible spaces of ownership that also recognize the need for communal ownership of a community in Inglewood that's been there for decades. And so it's that vibrancy. People are walking down the street more frequently than we had seen before. Foot traffic alone is definitely prominent and has allowed us to continue to grow. And so that buzz is coming back, and that's what's been incredible to be a part of. So our coffee is roasted in-house. So all the coffee that we sell is manufactured currently in our space in Inglewood. But we look across three different areas when we source our coffee as well: sustainability, traceability, and directness. And so that really all leads to, okay, what are the stories of the people that our coffee is coming from? In part, that means going out and meeting them. So we take visits to the different countries that we're sourcing our coffee from to meet the producers and meet the farmers on the ground, so that we not only know where our coffee is coming from, but they also know where their coffee is going. When we look across the landscape of LA and we see just an incredible amount of Black and Brown owned coffee shop spaces, that speaks to the presence at the end of the supply chain of a group of people that's reflected at the beginning. When we talk about origin and we go to Honduras or Jamaica or Ethiopia, we're visiting Black and Brown and Indigenous spaces. And so what I see in that reflection is really, how are we moving through the supply chain and supporting ownership throughout that supply chain so that we can recycle that back?
You've been listening to Shanita Nicholas and Amanda Jane Thomas, owners and founders of the proudly Black-owned cafe Sip and Saunder. Their flagship location is in Inglewood, and they've got two more outposts in Sherman Oaks and downtown LA. You can pick up a bag of beans roasted in-house or grab one of their signature drinks, like their Cardi Rose Latte or Spiced Pear Tonic. Mmm. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Fresh is boring, according to Li Wei Liao. It's a bold statement coming from a fishmonger. That is, unless you own the only market dry-aging fish in the U.S. Since 2017, Li Wei has been selling premium fish to those in the know in Sherman Oaks. Before the pandemic, he operated a restaurant as well, but as needs changed, he shifted into a wholesale program, which quickly became a favorite among local chefs. These days, he seems to do it all, selling hipster coffee, pastries, sandwiches, and his specialty, dry-aged fish, cut to order. And he does it all out of a storefront on Ventura Boulevard called The Joint. Hi.
Hello.
You were born in Taiwan, but grew up in Queens. Did you grow up fishing?
Yes, I did. I mean, fishing has always been part of my family's pastime. So from my earliest memories, I would, you know, remember fishing in New York growing up.
I love that. I think it would surprise a lot of people to just hear the words New York or Queens and fishing. They have such a different idea of what it's like to grow up there.
Yes, surprisingly, even though we grew up relatively close to the city, it was very accessible. You know, Long Island is surrounded by water on three sides. And even then, you go up to the Northeast, we had a lot of access to water, whether it's fresh water or salt water.
How did you get into the rabbit hole of dry aging fish?
So let me clarify. The term dry aging fish is rather poor because you don't want to call it dry and you don't want to call it aged. We are conditioning fish over time in a dry environment. So the product is not necessarily dry by any means, and it's not rotting or it's not decomposing. It's actually, our goal is to make it better than it was fresh. So the term dry aged fish is sometimes misunderstood. How did I get into it? It's really out of necessity. Growing up fishing, we had a lot of fish to work with. when you catch a lot of fish. Over time, we kind of developed a certain protocol or method to maintaining and preserving fish by different methods other than to throw it in the freezer. You know, this is all self-taught for ourselves.
I have to say that I've had your fish, and it's really just unbelievable. And it's just fascinating how different it is. Can you describe the process and what happens to the fish as time goes by in the controlled environment it's in?
So the controlled environment that it's in is very particular. Our main objective in conditioning the fish is to remove any components of the fish that would make it, first of all, fishy and make it go bad. With that being said, we try to remove blood, slime, and excess moisture. Excess moisture in forms of water content. That alone kind of purges and removes any kind of impurity that would make the fish taste fishy or off, or, you know, simply make it spoil a lot sooner. You know, by conditioning in that method, we produce a fish product that you then would be able to enjoy with very clean taste. The textures improve because of the lack of moisture or the reduced moisture. And, you know, overall, it's a better experience.
Could you go into more detail about how the texture changes?
So the texture changes by means of being firmer. When something is reduced in moisture, it kind of compacts down at a molecular level. So now you're eating fish that is tender, but not mushy. So it has more of a feedback when you bite into it. Everyone kind of knows or know fresh fish to be kind of very soft. If you picked up a fillet of fish that you kind of buy from any market, even though it has form, it doesn't have any kind of rigidity. It's very soft. You know, fish plops on the counter. And that's kind of like the texture that everyone is familiar with. However, when the fish is conditioned and has gone through this dry aging protocol, everything is firm. It's more like a denser piece of cheese versus a soft brie.
So interesting. And what does it do to the flavor? I imagine it concentrates.
Concentrates for one, and two, because we removed impurities that would taint your taste, where it's fishier or it carries more of a gaminess on the back end, all that's removed. So now you're tasting fish for what it should be tasting like without those impurities mudding or getting in the way of the flavor profile.
And where do you source your fish?
We're a direct buyer simply because we need fish of the highest quality and standard, because we can't really make a fish better if it's already getting bad. So for us, it's very critical that we receive fish as fast as possible from harvest, anywhere between 24 to 36 hours. We're sourcing fish from all around the world, the furthest being perhaps New Zealand and some parts of Europe. And everything gets to from door to door, from the harvest to our shop, all within 36 hours.
And do you have a preference for wild or farmed?
You know, at the shop, we do have both farmed and wild fish. However, I personally prefer farmed fish, which I like to refer to as aquacultured fish. Nowadays, aquaculture fish, the quality is much better. It's more controlled. It's more monitored. It's healthier in all senses. So I actually, the majority of fish that we utilize are aquacultured fish.
Aside from the fish itself, what other offerings can we find at your counter?
At our counter, you know, we're a gourmet fish market, so we'll have a lot of different kinds of fish, whether you want to do it, you know, a sushi night at home. We have a big selection of fish that is appropriate for sushi and other raw recipes. And we have a good selection of things that you would grill or oven bake. So we'll have those. We'll have some amount of shellfish and crustaceans. So, you know, we're just like a mini seafood market that focuses on fish, but we do have other items like Wagyu and prime beef, all dry aged as well. We have a coffee shop attached to the market. So we serve gourmet coffee, hipster coffee, and a daily bakery.
What an interesting story you have. Thank you so much for coming to chat with me today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
That was fishmonger and chef Li Wei Liao. Visit him at The Joint in Sherman Oaks, open Tuesdays through Sundays. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's another wet week in Southern California. Let's head to the very damp market now to see how farmers are faring after the rain.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. It has been an absolutely crazy day here at the market. 20 minutes ago, it was hailing and thundering. Now the sun is out. I'm here with a familiar face at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, Alain Giraud. How are you, sir?
I'm good. And I bring the sun to your plate, you see?
You brought the sunshine. So I remember when you had Anisette just around the corner here from the Farmers Market. Then you had Maison Giraud up in the Pacific Palisades. Tell us what you're up to now.
Since Maison Giraud have to close in 2016, I go back with my previous company with name Four Stars Private Cuisine, and I'm doing a private. I'm doing parties for my multiple client, mostly on the west side. I do teaching too, cooking class, lecture, a little bit of consulting, you know, like every chef without a restaurant.
Wow. Well, you've got more freedom now. You're still here at the farmer's market pretty much every single Wednesday. What are you shopping for today?
I have a client at this weekend and I'm doing a menu. I start doing at the COVID takeout for my house. Each week now, but I bought some blood orange to do an orange and asparagus salad. Is the farmer's market, outside of all the beautiful people, beautiful farmer like Peter, he give you a sense of a season. You know, look, Catherine, you have rhubarb. Rhubarb.
Just now,
yeah,
rhubarb.
We're just talking. So it's... I make a list, and the good thing is I never follow my list. I just look at. This week I'm doing a roast tribass with spring vegetables, so I will go to check. Peter don't have any chipolini onions, my favorite, but a blood orange with the end of the winter season. And I bought all the time some tomato from Valdivia. I'm ashamed to buy tomato during the winter, but it's luxury to be in California. Some citrus, some juice. I love the blood orange juice from Peter. Reduce it for sauce. It's amazing. It's very light. It's beautiful. And baby turnips, I'm sure today, I hope. Some radishes. It's just a sense of the season, you know, look around, and I'm very stable. I bought almost all the time the same thing and looking for new.
Sure.
It's a part of shopping at the market.
Oh, it's the best part about shopping at the market. So I have to ask, you did just say rhubarb.
Yeah.
You were clearly excited about it. Now I've seen it at a few stands. What would you do with that?
Once a while I cook it with just a touch of sugar, and we switch for, what's the name of the, Catherine, the monk food sugar to be more healthy. And you just cook with a touch of sugar, like a compote, and I do petit choux chantilly. I put that for the acidity, and the chantilly, creme chantilly on the top. That was my dessert for this Saturday, and I will add a little bit of touch of rhubarb now. And a classic French thing is rhubarb and strawberry, but it's too early for the strawberry.
I know. Yeah. The poor strawberry farmers have been hit so hard.
I grew up in a farmhouse in France, so I'm in love with farming and shopping at the market. It's I think it's a plus for us. And we're so lucky to have the Santa Monica Farmers Market. I mean,
the happiest place on earth.
Yeah, one of the happiest, yes, for sure.
All right, well, wonderful to see you here and great to know what you're up to. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure to see you again.
That was Chef Alain Giraud of Four Stars Private Cuisine. He does do takeout menus periodically. You can follow him on Instagram for all the details, at Chef Alain Giraud. Julia Tamai is one of the farmers who typically brings strawberries this time of year down to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. She's part of Tamai Family Farms and the daughter of Gloria Tamai, who is familiar to many people here at the market. Julia, I have been seeing some crazy images, videos online of what's been going on in Oxnard, the flooding that's occurred. Tell us what's happening at your property.
At our property right now, it is underwater on one corner where we have a lot of our herbs and arugula growing. We were able to pump out a lot into the ditch, so we were able to save our crop there. And then as far as our strawberry rows go, they're normally about, I want to say, two and a half feet deep just to walk through the row. And they filled up with water yesterday, and we were probably about 2 inches away from them going over the top and into the onto the actual berry plant. So it's been a struggle with all the water. For those of you that don't know, we tend to throw away a lot of strawberries. That's why when we tell you, when you purchase them, not to wash them till you're going to eat them and refrigerate them. So right now they're getting plenty of washing, and the hail, not to mention the hail, adds little indents on them. So don't expect perfect fruit this time of year with this kind of weather condition.
Now, you have lived in Oxnard your entire life. Have you ever seen it flood like this before?
Yes. Maybe when I was like 15. We're aging myself here, but about 25 years ago, we've had a lot of rain like this. I think it was almost during El Nino, I want to say. And that was a bad time for us as well. But we survived that, and we're going to survive this again. Just one day at a time.
Just one day at a time. That's right. So tell us what else we can expect with the strawberries. When you have this much moisture, does it actually change the flavor of the fruit too?
That's a very good question. Yes, it does. Like our skin, the strawberry skin is also very thin. So when it gets too much water, it actually starts retaining it. And so sometimes people will be like, oh, why does my strawberry taste watery? It's because of all the moisture in the water that we're getting from the rain. And it usually takes about one picking to clear out, or a lot of good sunshine. That's why everyone likes them during summer when it's warmer, because that's usually when they're sweeter. So the more sun they get, the tastier they are.
Okay, and the ones that are just barely above water right now, they will be salvaged?
No, we're probably throwing away 85% of our crop right now. So normally this time of year, we have tons of strawberries for the table, three different varieties. Right now we had 12 boxes for the table.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Now put that in comparison. When you say 12 boxes today, how many would you normally bring this time of year?
Normally we'd probably bring about 100, and today we had 12, and this is one of our larger markets. So it's pretty insane when you put it in those terms of what we're able to sell versus what we're throwing away.
Unbelievable. All right, so we could have a really great strawberry season in about, what, a month or so?
Hoping a month, maybe like 2 weeks, though, if we get all the sunshine that they say is coming our way. We're hoping for at least 1 to 2 weeks. It doesn't take much. We just have to clean the plant and then the sun, let the sun and nature do its thing.
All right. Well, this is so good for all of us farmers market shoppers to know. Thank you, Julia.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. That was Julia Tamai. She is from Tamai Family Farms, which are up in Oxnard. We can hopefully expect some beautiful berries coming to their stand within the next couple weeks. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laryl Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman, your Good Food host. Since you're listening to the show as a podcast, you may be unaware that it's produced by a public radio station. KCRW is listener-supported, and so we occasionally come to listeners to ask for funding to do what we do. Public radio is one of the original crowdfunding mechanisms, and we're grateful for it. This week is our spring pledge drive, and we're looking to you to count yourself in with a donation. It's a virtual circle. You give us support, and we spend our days combing the world for stories we think will resonate and inspire. And get this, we have one of the best sweeps ever this weekend, and it involves our first guest on today's show, Bertha. If you're a KCRW member and you live within 20 miles of downtown LA, and you donate on either Saturday, March 25th or Sunday, March 26th, then you could win a sassy pie baking class for you and five friends with Bertha. I mean, come on, does it get better than that? 4 hours of campy baking with Bertha for you and your besties. Of course, this is in honor of KCRW's Pie Fest and Contest, so whether you're a novice baker or a seasoned pro, pledge today for your chance to laugh and bake. Donate today by going to kcrw.com/give, and thank you so much. As always, I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.